Welcome to another edition of ITE 1, Class 1, Chapter 8, Networking Fundamentals. Now, before we get started on the networking, I want to go over and explain print spooling. And the reason for this is it's the one exam question which seems to have tripped up just about everyone in the class. Now, the print spooler is an area on your hard drive which temporarily stores print jobs. And so if cancelling a print job doesn't solve a non-printing problem, it may be necessary to stop and start the print spooler. And this is managed by a service on your computer. Remember your visits to msconfig and your visits to the services tab. You will have seen there's a print spooling service is under there. It's one of the many services which are on your machine. Now, services are found under computer management, which you will find under administrative tools under control panel on your machine. I guess if you put computer management into your search box as Windows 7 users, you will get to it. Even print spooler might actually do it. Now, you'd be looking for a service that's called Print Spooler, and you can start and stop the print the service from there. You can also do it from a command prompt, apparently, with the command net space start space spooler and net space stop space spooler. Now, does that make it clear as to why rebooting the computer was the other answer that was wanted?
Yep, I can now. And you can get there by typing print spool in the search engine.
That helps a lot.
That does help. Thank you.
Not a problem. I just, you know, because some of these questions tend to come up in finals as well, and in the more advanced exams, they sometimes throw these earlier questions at you to see how much you've retained. So it's good to know these things, especially if more than one of you's had difficulty with it. All right, networking. A computer network is a series of computers which connect to share the flow of information. This might be anything from your home network of two or the big bad internet. A computer network which combines information flow in differing ways, such as text, multimedia and telephone signals, is called a convergent network, and they're becoming increasingly common as time goes on. They were touted in the 90s and they took a while to arrive, but they're finally happening. Now, the pathways along which the information flow can vary from a single cable through to radio signals to a complex array of routers and network centres. A computer data network is a collection of hosts connected by networking devices. A host is any device that sends and receives information on the network, and generally, as a rule of thumb, it has its own IP address, and we'll talk about IP addresses later. Now, peripherals are devices that are connected to hosts. So there are some devices that can be hosts or peripherals. For instance, a printer connected to your laptop that is on a network is acting as a peripheral. If the printer is connected directly to the networking device, like a hub or a switch or a router, it's acting as a host. Is everybody clear on that?
So if I can use my example here, my printer is connected to my computer, and then my daughter uses it via the router. That makes my printer a peripheral. But if I had my printer plugged directly into the router and we both used it, that would make it a host.
Yes, because at the moment your printer is being shared, but it doesn't have its own IP address. So, yeah, it's even though it's being shared by the two of you, it's connected to your computer and not directly to the network. Yep, that's you've got it. Okay, a network can share things like services, like printing and scanning, storage space, a huge library of hard drives, although that's becoming more of a home thing now, or given the size of hard drives you can buy for home use, and applications like databases. And these things are linked together by network devices using a variety of connections, from copper cabling, which is still the most common, through to radio waves, and that's infrared, Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, and satellite, and we'll be talking about all of those as well. Look at the diagram and see how it handles the print job it's undertaking. So that's 8.1.1. There's a diagram at the end of that. And note how it's undertaking its print job to see what I mean. All right. Okay. Why are we doing all this? Why do we have networks?
Well, one of the benefits of having a network is to be able to maximize the use of minimal resources.
Exactly. What else?
Yeah, I was pretty much Kate said, sharing the information.
So what are the benefits to sharing HAP?
It means that more people can access single, for instance, database without everybody having to have the same database on their computer.
Yeah, so costs come down, right?
Yes, because you can buy a network license for software and many people can access it, and therefore, shazam, costs come down.
What about increased communication?
Yeah, well, what you can do is that your network can have its own email server, so that it's easier for people to transfer information to each other.
Yeah, like on a VPN, you know, it's a private network that many people are sharing resources.
Exactly, and it's also easy for them to collaborate using chats and fora and VoIP and all that good stuff. Yeah, you can also avoid file duplication and corruption, and site licensing is also another one. Now, what about centralized administration? Why is that a good thing?
Well, if you've got centralized administration, you've got one person who is in control of the security, the backup, and also the permissions for the network.
Exactly, Kate. Boy, I don't know if I need to teach you guys anything, really. You know, this is good stuff. There are a couple of disadvantages, of course, and one of those is that the more complex networks get, the more difficult they tend to be to troubleshoot. But we'll look at troubleshooting next week. Okay, types of networks. Now, the networks are usually defined by things like the area they serve, how the data is stored, how the resources are managed, how the network is organized, and the type of devices used, and also the type of media used to connect the devices. Media in this case refers to anything like the kinds of cables, and we'll talk about all the different kinds of those later on as well. Now, the first kind of network is a LAN, or local area network. And that's a group of interconnected devices that is under the same administrative control. That's the important bit. It doesn't matter whether they're geographically separated or not. If they're under the same administrative control, then it's a LAN. And this can be anything from your local home network or a group of enterprise level networks. A LAN used to be only a local network years ago, but the definition of a LAN now is the most important part of that definition is that it's all under the same administrative control. A WAN, on the other hand, or a wide area network, connects LANs in geographically separated locations. And of course, the most common example of that is the big bad internet. The internet is the ultimate WAN, really, that is composed of millions of interconnected LANs. And telecommunications service providers are used to interconnect these LANs at different locations. Of course, within the ultimate LAN, there are other smaller WANs as well, and I would guess that the Cisco Corporation would be a WAN because with such a big organization, you wouldn't want one administrator or one central admin controlling the manufacturing and Netacad, for instance, because they're quite disparate. Is everyone clear so far?
Yep.
Cool. Okay, a WLAN is connected by radio waves instead of traditional cable. Wireless devices are connected to an access point within a specific area, and access points are typically connected to the network using copper cabling, but they're the only things that use cabling. Everything connected to the access point uses radio waves. And of course, that has lots of advantages and disadvantages. The range or radius of coverage for typical WLAN systems varies from under 30 metres indoors for things like Bluetooth to much greater distances outdoors depending on the technology. Okay, so we're all clear what a LAN, a WAN and a WLAN are. Okay, yes?
Yep.
Cool. Now, peer-to-peer and client-server networks. That's the next thing we need to discuss. Now, your home network usually is a peer-to-peer network, and the characteristics of those are that they have no central control. So, for instance, on Kate's network, which she and her daughter uses, they do their own updates, their own backup, all that kind of thing, or they can do. It's not under one person's centralized control.
Except parental control, of course.
Of course. This is also good in a small office environment. But it has its downside. Because there's no central admin, it means there's no one person responsible for controlling what goes on. There's no central security, means that potentially protection can get a bit patchy as well. And as the complexity increases, you need to find that you need a much more efficient system. And all this lack of control includes a lack of central backup and permissions. So once you get past, say, about 10 hosts, you start running into problems with peer-to-peer.
In that peer-to-peer as well, there'd be a lot of problem with document duplication and corruption or possible corruption of databasing, wouldn't there?
Potentially, yes, yeah. Which is why it's only really good for home networks and very small businesses. Yep.
What we used to do, I now no longer have a peer-to-peer network. Mine's client-server, if you want to tell them about what I've got going here, Kylie. But when I ran a peer-to-peer network with Vicky when I was over the other side of the road, I deemed that for all the business stuff, I think, we actually used her machine as the server, even though it was officially peer-to-peer. I made a decision that I would use her machine as the as where we kept our websites and the, you know, the non websiteable files and any client records we had. And that was an administrative decision on my part, because I think she left her computer running more often, and I don't know, it's just the way I decided to set it up, and she didn't care. So what that means is, for Kate's issue of duplication of documents, is that we just decided to make hers, what was on her machine was the one that was God, basically. My machine occasionally served as a backup, or have I connected up a removable hard drive to that machine. So although it was still officially client-server, one way you can get around that document duplication is, say, in your household, Kate, would be to say, all right, Mum's the boss. Everything on my machine's the original version, and if you've got another copy of it, well, it's my copy that wins if we have to back it up or restore it or any of that sort of stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, luckily that situation doesn't arise here, but that was one of the things that I was thinking about, that you could end up causing document and database difficulties if you didn't make some sort of conscious decision to make one person or one person's computer the boss, so to speak.
Yeah, we did that because I had the fun stuff on my machine, like all the MP3s. So I didn't want all the business stuff on my machine.
Yeah, and of course,
you don't want to spoil a good thing.
You got it.
Of course, in a business situation in a small office, if you had peer-to-peer arrangements, you'd need to do something similar as well, yeah. But of course, if you wanted to be more efficient, you'd go and grab a server, and that's what we're going to talk about next. A server
and that
manages
expensive
network resources. It's getting less.
Not so. If you know what you're doing. But let Kylie, I'll explain what I did after Kylie gives you the official Cisco bit.
Okay, a server manages network resources. Servers store data and share it with users on a network. Confidential or sensitive data can be protected and shared with the users who have permission to access it. Document tracking software can be used to prevent users from overwriting files or changing files that others can access. And that others are accessing at the same time, which is, of course, really important. Now, the client requests information or services from the server. The server provides the requested information or service to the client. Servers on a client-server network. Servers on a client-server network commonly perform some of the processing work for client machines. For instance, sorting through a database before delivering only the records requested by the client. For instance, if I was connected to Elise's server and received my email that way, and say if Kate was and John was, then my email would only come to me and not to everybody. Okay.
Yeah, basically what I've got here is a small Linux server. This is the second one I've run in the time I've known Kylie. And the first one was actually given to me. The second one I think I paid less than $200 for, because believe it or not, it's a net-top computer. It runs Linux, so it's a little bit smaller than your average EEE PC, 10-inch EEE PC. It's an Asus machine, and basically I run Linux on that. And I could go all the hog like Kerry does and have multiple servers, and our friend Will does the same thing, but I just couldn't be bothered. And essentially, my friends log on it and get stuff off it and put stuff on it, and Yeah, Kylie does have an email account there at lonstarmedia.org if she ever chooses to use it. But yeah, if people are here, it means that I can access all the information on one machine or any other machine that's around the house. I can go out and work just as efficiently from the laptop that's sitting on the dining room table, because nothing of importance is saved on any of the clients. So I'll say that again, nothing of importance is saved on any of the clients. It's all saved in a central location, thus making it a heck of a lot easier to back it all up. And I ran it back up this morning, actually. So it's centrally located, it's centrally backed up, and as Kylie said, it's under the same administrative control. It's all under the one central control. Pretty much all the email comes through there as well, and it does serve up some small websites as well. So everything gets backed up when I back that up.
So before we move on to the next section, there's just a couple of little networking terms I've got here that they want you to know, and they are work group. And that's a collection of computers on a LAN that share common resources and responsibilities. And these are normally peer-to-peer arrangements and or segments of a large network. And we'll talk about dividing network into segments in a very general way in a while. In Windows, you can assign individual hosts to a named group. And that's all about your computer names. So in a classroom, for instance, one classroom would be a work group within a segment. And it would be called, you know, class 3, computer 1 to 12, for instance. So, yeah, that way the admin knows where the computer is and what it is, or where the device is and what it is. That's the advantage of naming. Okay, the other term that you need to be a little bit familiar with is the term domain. And this is a portion of a network which is grouped logically, and we'll talk about logical addressing in a while as well, usually via IP address. Unlike a work group, the hosts on a domain don't have to be in the same physical location, though they are under one point of secure control. Members of a domain also authenticate to one point to gain access to the network. So what that really means is that they don't have to be in the same room, but they're all on the network and they can all see each other. They're all addressed logically so that they're on the same network or network segment. Okay, we've got any questions before we move on to things like bandwidth? All good. Okay, we're going to be talking next about bandwidth and data transmission, IP addressing, DHCP, internet protocols and applications, and ICMP. So here's where we start to get into the nitty-gritty. First, a little bit about bandwidth. And bandwidth is the amount of data that can be transmitted within a fixed time period, and that is expressed as bits per second, usually, or sometimes bytes per second. So you will get terms like kbps, kilobits per second, and mbps, megabits per second. A byte is equal to 8 bits and is abbreviated with a capital letter, where the bit is abbreviated with a small letter. Okay, like a highway, the more the lanes, the greater the traffic, and similarly, the wider the bandwidth, the greater the transmission of data. So at this point, that's all you need to know. We'll talk a bit more about bandwidth later, probably next week. But the other term is latency, and you'll hear that from time to time bandied around, and that refers to the way traffic flows and how it might be delayed by media or devices. For instance, if you've got a noisy cable somewhere in the works, that will cause latency. Now, this isn't usually a problem, except when using video or VoIP, and sometimes it can be a problem on Ventrilo that we can have latency. And mainly the problem is because of the different protocols used. There's one protocol that is better for voice and video, and we'll talk about those protocols later on, those transport protocols. But for now, there are three forms of data transmission you need to know, and the first one is simplex. And simplex is unidirectional, single, one-way transmission. And that's like your TV or radio. It communicates with you, you don't communicate with it. That's simplex. Half duplex is when data flows in one direction at a time. It's two-way alternating communication. And a good example of that, of course, is our push-to-talk feature on Ventrilo. That's half duplex, We can only talk or hear. We can't talk and be heard at the same time. Full duplex is two-way simultaneous communication like Skype or the telephone. Both parties can talk and be heard at the same time. Although the data flows in both directions, the bandwidth is measured in only one direction. So, a network cable with 100 megabits per second in full duplex mode still has a bandwidth of 100 megabits per second. Okay, are we all clear? Are there any questions? I haven't bamboozled you all yet, that's good. Okay. Broadband technology lets multiple signals travel on the same wire simultaneously. And DSL is a really good example of that. All right, so we're all clear on that because next we're going on to some new information. Okay, IP addressing. All right, an IP address is a number that is used to identify a device on the network. Remember I said each device on a network must have a unique IP address to communicate with other network devices. It's a bit like your name. You've got a unique name or handle that somebody calls you to distinguish you from somebody else. It's pretty much like that. As noted earlier, a host is a device that sends or receives information on the network. Network devices are devices that move data across the network, and they are things like hubs, switches, and routers. On a LAN, each host and network device must have an IP address within the same network to be able to communicate with each other. So, as long as those devices are within the same network, they can communicate. And we'll talk about a little bit more about that now. Now, an IP address is a series of 32 binary bits, that's ones and zeros, but that's kind of hard for humans to read and even harder to type. So we divide it up into four groups of 8-bit bytes called octets. So the 32 bits are divided up into four groups of eight. But that's still hard to deal with, so we give the values decimal rather than binary values with a dot between each octet. And that's called dotted decimal notation. So each of you now go and open a notepad file and type in the following thing for me. Tell me when you've opened your files.
Open.
Already.
Oh, got it.
Cool. Right, first line, 192 space. Now, if you had to express that in its binary form, which would be very difficult, you would have 110000000.
Am I to type that or to listen to you?
You can type that in and you can see how much this is going to get more we're going to show you an IP address in binary, and that'll tell you just how difficult it would be to express, but also it'll give you an idea of what it looks like.
How many zeros was that?
Would you say the whole thing again?
It's please? Two ones and six zeros. Because remember, we are talking about eight bits.
What you can remember about these octets is that eight oct is the root word for eight. Because
exactly.
October used to be the eighth month of the year. And we're talking about eight bits here. So each group of eight bits is a byte. And that's why we call it an octet. And there's four of these little octets. And 4 times 8 is what?
Oh, not 32, surely.
32.
Surely, there you go. These people are getting it. There you go.
Cool. So the first part of the IP address would be 192, which in binary is 110000000. Go to the new line and type 168. And then space. And then 10101000. So you're getting to know now how difficult that would be if we had to work in pure binary form. Next line is the number 1. So if you type the number 1 and then space, then in binary, of course, that's 7 zeros followed by a 1. Remember, we're always talking about each octet has to be expressed as an octet. So it doesn't matter how many zeros are in there, you still have to express them to make up the 8 bits.
So we've got 8 numbers regardless of whether they're zeros or ones.
Exactly. Now the last line is 5. So if you type the number 5 and then press space and then 0000001001. Now, that would be hellish to try and remember or type, wouldn't it? That's why we express them, those binary numbers, as decimals, and they have a dot in between. Except, of course, when you're typing them into the computer itself, it moves to each field, which means you don't actually have to put the dot in. Okay, so you don't need to know anything more about binary at this point. You just need to know
that
we express these. No.
No. Incidentally, that's all the computer sees is the binary, but it can count better than you can. So, it doesn't even see the dots. So it just sees 32 bits of ones and zeros all lined up there, and it can figure it out. But we can't, so we like to turn it into decimal.
Deck we make life root word for 10.
So there's no actual, calculation to convert it or anything like that, or...?
There is, if you want to do CCNA level courses, but we don't have to go into that today. If you want to discuss binary with
and
it,
here is a plug for
free,
CCNA
cool.
Discovery 1 with Elise and Jackie. Oh no, it's just Elise this year anyway. There you go. Chapter 5, gang. Get the lectures down, they're open to everybody.
They are, but hey, binary is kind of fun. So if you want to go that far, hey, I'm happy to talk to you about binary, that's cool, but not in this lecture.
Oh yeah, Kylie loves it, off channel. don't scare the IT students. Not today, anyway.
No, I won't. Okay. Now that you know about IP addresses and they have to be, each device has to have a unique one, the next thing you need to know is that they are hierarchical, and that means there's one part for the network and one part for the host, and you need both parts in an IP address. For example, in an address of 192.168.18.57, your first 3 octets are for the network and the fourth is for the host. That's a Class C address, by the way, and we'll talk about more about classes in a minute. IP addresses are divided into the following 5 classes. Class A is usually found on large networks implemented by large companies and some countries. For instance, my old IP address used to be a Class A and it started with 10. Now, Class B addresses are for medium-sized networks implemented by universities, and Class C is usually found on small networks implemented by ISPs for customer subscriptions. There are 2 more classes, but you don't need to know about them in this course. Class D for multicasting and Class E for experimental testing. But you only need to know about A, B, and C. Now, there are 2 ways you can tell what class of IP address you're dealing with. One of them is by the use of something called the subnet mask. The subnet mask indicates the network portion of an IP address. The subnet mask indicates the network portion of an IP address. Like the IP address, the subnet mask is also a dotted decimal number. And usually all hosts within a LAN use the same subnet mask, but not always. Okay, so for Class A addresses, your subnet mask would be 255.0.0.0. So if you see that, you know that the IP address that goes with it is going to have to be a Class A. Class B is 255.255.0.0. And of course...
Yeah, that's right.
Yep, that indicates that the first 2 octets of the IP address is the network portion. So in Class A, the first octet only is the network portion and the other 3 are host. Think of it as, pieces of a pie. So if you take a quarter of that in a Class A network, 1/4 for the network, 3/4 for the host. In a B, it's half and half. Half for the network, half for the host. In a C, where the subnet mask is 255.255.255.0, That indicates that the first three octets of the IP address is the network portion. And IP addresses also map to these. Any questions so far?
I just want to make a point for any would-be network people coming from other courses. We are referring to the default subnet mask in the cases outlined by Kylie.
Yeah, we don't need to know about that, actually, in this course.
No, but I'm just saying, because you can get different subnet masks, as you well know, which are the custom ones that we won't talk about in this course, because we don't want to scare everyone away.
The subnet mask will also indicate how a network is to be divided up, if you want to do that. And again, if you want to get into networking, you get to do subnetting and this sort of thing. Yes, Kate?
So my router is one that I got through Telstra. So its address is 192.168, I think it's 00. So what I guess I'm asking is, all of the Telstra routers would have that 192.168 at the beginning of them, or they would all have exactly the same IP address?
Tends to be brand specific, yes. So you will get brands like Elisa's, which are 192.168.1.something, and my ones, which are .0.something. So they tend to be brand specific, but you can change that. Tell you what.
I changed mine because I sort of built the network around having a previous router. So the last three routers have been set to the old billion standard, which is 192.168.1.254. They are brand specific, as Kylie said. So your router is probably 192.168.0.1 would most
Same
likely
with
me. Be its address, which is
In
what
fact,
Kylie's
we can find
got.
Out.
Yes, we can.
Open a command prompt for me. Tell me when you've done it.
Open.
Kate?
Yeah.
Okay, now type the word ipconfig, one word. We won't make you do the all at this point because it's way too much information. Just type ipconfig, press enter, and tell me what information you get.
Connections specific suffix.
In your case, ladies and gentlemen, you'll be looking at the default gateway line, which will give you the address of your integrated services router or the near side interface of your router that you're connected to. In two lines above that will, of course, be your computer's IP address. And you'll see a Class C subnet mask in amongst all that too. So happy reading.
Usually you will. Okay. So, John, what does ipconfig tell you that the IP address of your computer is?
Do you want me to do mine?
Yes, Kate, go ahead.
I've got 192.168.0, and then I've got a 181. So
yep, that's fine. That's legal.
Yep.
Yeah, but
to me.
I think that
192.168.0.181 will be fine. Yep, that's a good address to have.
But doesn't that 181 change because I haven't got my thing set to a specific IP address, like it searches for it automatically?
Yes,
yep,
it will.
It's
and
the
we'll
local
DHCP
server doing that.
We'll talk about DHCP in a little while.
Have a look two lines below that, Kate, and tell us what it says. You'll see the subnet mask just below that, and you'll see the default gateway and tell us what that is. It'll be 192.168.0.something.
Yeah, see, that's right. My default gateway is 192.168.0.1, and that's what I type in when I want to actually go in and modify the router.
There you go. Geez, these people are learning stuff, aren't they?
Oh, I know, it's fantastic.
I've got other information too, which I don't understand. Sort of
okay.
Something about tunnel adapter and tunnel
yep,
adapter.
It'll tell us about, it'll give you all the interfaces on that machine. ipconfig will tell us about if you've got a wireless interface as well as a Ethernet interface. So in Kim's case, she'll see that on the laptop. I think Kate's on a desktop. I'm not sure what you're running, Terry. So it depends on how many interfaces you've got. So you will need to pick the right one.
Yeah, no, okay. I'm on
this
a laptop
says,
as well.
Yes, John.
This says space period, space period, space period, space period.
John, there's a whole lot of ellipses right across the screen. It's like a dotted line across to the information at the far side. You might find it easier to virtualize your window.
Then 2001:0:4137:9E76:.
That sounds like an IPv6 address. Ooh, right. That's going to confuse
unless it's giving us his MAC address.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, it does. It'll give you the hardware address. Yeah, it'll give you a hardware address as well, because it'll tell you what the hardware, the interface is. That you're probably
IP
looking at the MAC address. Hey?
It says IP6 address.
Oh, you could have
yep,
one.
Thought it was. Yeah, it sounded like IPv6 to me. So you're on IPv6. Well,
see, I've got
been nice and translated.
I've got an IP6 address at the bottom of mine as well.
Okay. Well, just before we talk a little bit about IPv6, there are two ways you can tell class A, B, and C addresses. One is by the subnet mask, and the other one is by the number of the first octet. In a class A address, the first octet is going to be between 10 and 128. Okay, so between 10 and 128. In a class B address, the subnet mask is, of course, going to be 255.255.0.0, and the first number of the first octet in the B class address is going to be between 129 and 191, 129 and 191. In a class C address, the first octet is going to be between 192 and 223. So that's also handy to remember. Now, yes.
I think these people, you all on Windows 60, Windows 7, you two getting your IPv6 addresses?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, now if you go further up, you'll probably still see an IPv4. This is some adapter that I'm not familiar with. It'd be rather cool if we had Kerry here, he could tell us what it is. It's a, hang on, I'll read it to you from the microphone down. I've got it as well. It's a tunnel adapter Torito thing. And I'm not really sure what it is, but it evidently it's probably some virtual adapter that sort of comes with IPv, with Windows 7. It's giving us an IPv6 interface. So that's interesting. I didn't even know that. There you go.
I have one too.
Well, you're another Windows 64-bit 7 person, so there you go.
Okay, now Elise mentioned the MAC address. You'll also find that on that information by typing ipconfig. And what that is it's a permanent 48-bit address. It's burned into your network interface. It doesn't change. An IP address can change because it's a logical address. But the MAC address is also called the physical address, MAC meaning Media Access Control, and that will not change. Now, MAC has to do with frames, and we'll talk about frames a bit further on into the chapter. But
layer
for now,
two.
That's all you need to know about the MAC address, and IP addresses have to do with packets. Okay, now, just before we move on to the next section, I will talk a little bit about IPv6. There's a paragraph in your notes about it, so you may want to read it, because now that you've learned all that about IPv4, I'm now going to tell you that this system is all but obsolete. And the reason for this is the current system of IP addresses is a finite one, providing a total of 4,294,967,296 addresses. And we have now officially run out.
And how long did it take you to practice that number?
Long, actually, because Jaws read it out to me initially, and now I'm reading off the braille. I've just memorized it.
Would have taken me a week to practice that to get it right in a lecture.
Do you only want the non-graphical ones? Oops, sorry, wrong button.
Sorry, okay. Now, this is called IPv6, and it's expressed as 128 bits instead of 32, and that's expressed in 8 16-bit hexadecimal values with colons separating the blocks instead of periods. Now, I'm not going to do any more on this because you don't need to know too much more, but do read the paragraph in your notes. Now, IPv6 also has more efficient routing, integrated security through the use of data encryption, automatic configuration so that a device can assign itself to an IP address if needed, and quality of service support so that time-sensitive data has priority over other data. So it's much more efficient. And there's a diagram at the end of 8.2.2, which is very confusing, so don't stress about it. Are we all clear on what IP addresses are so far? Has anyone got any questions before we move on?
Just a quick one, hopefully. To do with, excuse me, with the classes, is there sort of a difference in quality, or sort of what do the class do, apart from obviously the IP number and things like that?
Well, of course, the greater the proportion of the IP address that is for the network, the fewer number of hosts you can have on that network. So if you take the piece of pie again, you take a Class A network with only the first octet being the network portion, you have all the rest of that pie available for hosts. And of course with Class B it's half and half, and Class C it's three quarters or three octets to one octet for the host. So it's not so much about quality of network, although a lot of Class C addresses are also private, and I will talk a little bit about that in a minute. But it's not about quality, it's about network size.
I don't know if it matters, Terry. Kylie can tell us, but like Apple is Class A and Microsoft is Class B.
No, actually. Now, everything's pretty much industry standard now.
Yeah. It's basically means the less, how do we express this? The more networks you have, the less hosts on each network you can get. The greater amount of hosts, the less networks. And I can give you the IP ranges if you want me to. I don't think it's in the test though. But there are certain, you know, we see this 192.168 business. We know, Kylie and I know that's a Class C address because we've done networking, but there are the ranges that can tell you, and I can read those out if anyone wants them.
I just read them earlier.
Cool.
Do we close this msconfig?
Yes, you can. Just type exit and press enter.
Did you tell them how many hosts you can have on each of these networks, or didn't you bother?
No, it doesn't seem to be in the notes now, but you can easily research that. It's available all over the net, this sort of information. It's the very fundamentals of networking, so it's not hard to find. But just
16,700,000 on a Class A, so it's a lot of hosts, gang, and right down to 254 hosts on a Class C, so you can see the difference.
Okay, so but typing all that information in manually, especially if you've got a larger network, is a hassle. So there's something called Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, or DHCP. And that's a software utility which automatically assigns IP addresses. This takes the hassle and potential errors, of course, because if you get even one number wrong, you'll get errors or you'll fail to connect out of configuring all these addresses manually. Once you set a computer to obtain an IP address automatically, all the other options in the dialog box are dimmed. DHCP can assign the IP address, the subnet mask, the default gateway, which is usually the address of your router, and it's the gateway between the inside of your network and the outside, and the optional values such as domain name system, DNS. And what DNS does is resolves IP names to IP addresses. So when you type www.cisco.com, you're using DNS, because what that has to do is it has to go and find the relevant IP address and give it back to HTTP/2 so it can access the relevant information for you. Okay, a DHCP is actually on a server and it receives a request from a host. The server then selects an IP address information from the set of predefined addresses that are stored in a database. When the IP address information is selected, the DHCP server offers these values to the requesting host on the network. If the host accepts the offer, the DHCP server leases the IP address for a specific period of time. The server maintains a list of IP addresses to assign and manages the process so that every device on the network receives a unique IP address. Theoretically, of course, things go wrong and we can discuss what would happen in that case later. Each address is held for a predetermined amount of time. Yep.
Is it, when you say it leases it for a certain amount of time, is that like I lease a house for a certain amount of time?
Yes, what happens is it gives the address to that device for a predetermined amount of time, and then the address goes back in the pool to be reassigned if necessary. That's why it's called Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol.
And Kate alluded to this before. She was asking about her 192.168.0161 or 181 address. That address is obviously in the pool of addresses to be leased to her machine by the local DHCP server, which in her case will be built into her little router somewhere or integrated services device. So you can narrow that down and make it only lease out. My old router used to only lease out addresses above 100, anywhere between 100 and 253, actually. 253. The new one I've got seems to give them out all over the place as long as they're not already used.
So if I was to go into config tomorrow, that 181 might be a slightly different number at the end of the IP address.
It could well be, unless sometimes, depending on the lease, it might just say, well, that's the same computer logging on, it can have it back. So usually the final default's 24 hours, but it may or may not change. If you left it for any more than a day or so, it probably would, yeah.
And so if I went and looked at that on my daughter's, that would be the same because she's using the same router, or would that be different?
No, it can only have one IP address. It can only be, it's like having several people on the same telephone number, for example, so you can't have that happening. So your daughter will have a different IP address. And in your case, it will be between 192.168.0.2 to 192.168.0.254, and it obviously won't be the one that you're using. So because you can't have two people with the same IP address on the same network segment.
Yeah, each device needs a unique IP address on that segment. So yeah, every device. So if you had a printer plugged in, it would have an IP address in that same range, between 1 and 254 for the last octet, because you've got a Class C address.
So I put my Braille note and her Braille note on as well, and they'll both have two other IP addresses other than the two that the laptops will have.
Exactly, but they'll all start with 192.168.0 because they all need to be on the same network to be able to communicate with your router.
Yeah, I think I understand that at last.
Cool.
Okay, so if someone came in with a different address, say it was 192.168.1 dot something, they wouldn't be able to communicate with things on your network because, why?
Because the 0 and the 1 are not the same. They wouldn't be on the same host. I think that's the word.
Same network segment is what you're looking for.
Same network segment, yep, because remember, it's on a Class C network, it's the first three that need to be the same. So it's the first three octets for the network and the fourth one for the host. So if you've got the third octet different, then it's on a different network segment for a Class C.
Oh, I see. So the Class C is three and the third one is the network segment. Right. Okay, thank you.
The fourth one is the host, so the first three are for the network.
Other networks, yeah. And they have to all be the same for the hosts on network to communicate.
Oh, yeah, I think I get it. Yep.
So everybody on the same network of 192.168.0 can chat. And the moment somebody tries to put themselves on 192.168.1 dot something or other, they can't chat. They would need to be routed across to the former network. So basically that 192.168.1 is made up of 24 bits, and I won't explain exactly why, and they're all for the network component. So they have to match. All those 192.168.0s have to match. On the fourth octet, which is your last 8 bits, that's how we get from 24 to 32 with the last 8 bits. The hosts can be anywhere. There's actually two reserved addresses that we won't discuss unless Kylie says we have to, because she's the one running the chapter, that you can't use. But most of those addresses that you can use, which is why your Braille note, your daughter's machine, and your own computer can be anywhere on that network segment and able to chat.
Okay, now if you choose to assign all these things automatically and you do that through the TCP/IP properties on your network interface card, and for you Windows 7 users it's called TCP/IP V4 or V6 depending on which you're working under. We'll use V4 in this case because it's just easier. Sometimes the computer can't get DHCP, it can't communicate with the server to obtain an IP address. The Windows operating system will automatically assign a private IP address. If your computer is assigned an IP address in the range of 169.254.0.0 to 169.254.255.255, your computer can only communicate with other computers in the same range. And that might be good in a classroom situation when you want to prevent access from outside the network. But this feature is called Automatic Private IP Addressing, a PIPA, APIPA. Now, a PIPA continually requests an IP address at 5-minute intervals from a DHCP server for your computer. So if someone is having trouble connecting to the internet and you see they've got an address of 169.254.something.something and think, oh, okay, this isn't getting DHCP, you'll know that that's probably what the problem is. And that is a test alert.
And a very vague one too, because they're out to get you, these English tests. Just see that question in the exam and remember exactly what Kylie has just told you, because if you get a bit anxious with that, you might skip the bleeding obvious, like we almost did the other day when we looked at it. But we won't tell you that bit.
No, there's all kinds of things that can cause it, but the most likely causes are things like the incorrect address or a bad cable or, you know, things like that. So, yeah, the bad cable probably would be the most likely cause because it's not getting the connection.
Indeed.
Okay.
Don't we just have Uncle Cisco?
Yeah, I know. Also, in that dialog box, when you're setting up to automatically assign, it can automatically assign your DNS addresses if you want to. And that also works on a server. And that's really all you need to know about DNS in this course. Just that DNS is a way of resolving URLs, your www's, to their relevant IP addresses. Okay, now you need to think of a network as having an inside and an outside, an internal part and an external part. And all your lovely 192.168.0.1.whatever addresses are private addresses, so they can't be seen on the internet. And it's your default gateway, which is usually the address of your router, which is the gateway between the private part, which can only be seen by people on your network, and the public part of the internet. And that's called NATing, or Network Address Translation. It's a way of translating your private address into a public address that can be seen on the internet and used. And that's really all you need to know about NATing. Okay, before we go on to a little bit about protocols and ports and things like that, are there any questions? We're now halfway through the lecture in terms of time. We've spent quite a lot of time on this, but it is important because it's actually at the fundamental basis of all networking. Well, either I've bamboozled you all completely or you all know exactly what I'm talking about. I hope the latter, but you just never know with me, you know. Okay, protocols. A protocol is a set of rules, and societies are full of them. There are social protocols and postal protocols and ceremonial protocols and all kinds of things. Internet protocols are sets of rules governing communication within and between computers on a network. Messages need to move in a timely, efficient manner and in the right form and format. Protocols can govern identifying errors, compressing how the data is compressed, and they can decide how the data is to be sent and how it's to be addressed, and they can decide how to announce, send and receive data. Okay, some protocols have suites of other protocols within them in layers or stacks, and we'll discuss some of them as time passes. Now, in your notes, you'll find the two diagrams in 8.4 contain all the info you could want, and I have condensed them into one for easy of understanding. I hope it makes easier anyway. But you need to learn these, and specifically their port numbers. There's no easy way to remember port numbers of these things. It's just all rote learning. For instance, HTTP, which is the one you use when you access your browser, uses port 80. So every time you pull up a website, you're using that. Now, we all use SMTP to send our email. SMTP is the protocol that everyone uses to send email. And the standard port number for that is 25. Some of us don't use 25. We use a secure port, which is something else, but 25 is the standard port number for SMTP. Now, when you receive your email, you can receive it by POP, Post Office Protocol, which most of you will do, I would think, and that's port 110. What Elise and I do is we receive our email by IMAP. Now, you don't need to know what that is yet. It's probably covered in the advanced chapter. But that's port 143. So read through the notes that I've sent you and learn those all those ports. You'll find that some of these protocols don't have a port number because that means they're a suite of protocols. And the best and most well-known and dominant one of those is TCP/IP. Okay, are we all clear on that before we go on to more fun with the command line? Oh, no answer.
Wakey, wakey.
Hello, no answer with the student reply. They'll wake up in a minute because I'll get them to use the command line again. You watch. Okay. Because
okay,
we're
going
to talk. Meet our friend ICMP. ICMP is a great little troubleshooting tool. You can get all kinds of. Do all kinds of things with ICMP. It's Internet Control Message Protocol. And it's used by devices on a network to send, control, and error messages to computers and servers. There are several different uses for ICMP, such as announcing network errors, announcing network congestion, and troubleshooting, and that's where you'll get to use it most often. Okay, the first one, I want you to open a command prompt, please, again for me.
Yep.
Tell me when you're done.
Yep.
Okay, first one is packet Internet Groper, ping, P-I-N-G, and it's commonly used
to test
connections
between computers.
It's amazing
how many people remember the groper bit.
Yes, you can ping
P-I-N-G
an IP address.
Is... Yes, packet Internet Groper.
Yes, and it doesn't go ping, only Monty Python does that. Anyway.
A machine can... that goes ping.
Yes. You can ping an IP
as long as it doesn't go ning tong ni li pa.
No, my dad used to do that when he got bored. He used to be a drummer in an Air Force band, and when he got bored and they were having a jam session, he would do that. He'd clash his cymbals and just sing that instead. Yeah. Anyway, you can ping an IP address to test IP connectivity. Okay. Type now, folks, ping space google.com and press enter.
My window eyes was talking. I'm sorry. Say it again, please.
Ping space.
It's google.com and press enter. Now what will happen is it will send out four little packets, IPM messages to Google, and Google will reply with either the packets back or nothing at all. And that will indicate either that there's no connection there, which it won't because we're using the net now, or that they've got ping turned off. So it's an ecosystem.
And this is very good for troubleshooting, because when you do troubleshooting, you'll be pinging things like your local gateway. You can ping an IP address, and you can ping a website, which Kylie just got you to do. And obviously, if you're going to ping your local IP address of your router and you're not getting anywhere, well, don't even bother pinging the website, because it won't work. But we'll talk about that in troubleshooting.
We will. You ping. You work outwards from your local and out to your router and then out to the outside world. That's the way you usually use to test. So, what did you all hear when you pinged google.com?
Well, I got four replies with different numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I got four replies, approximate and average.
And I got, yeah, some ping statistics.
Okay, and that would have told you the average time it took for the replies to come back in milliseconds. That MS is milliseconds. So you can see that if you're pinging something and you don't, and you get, okay, type ping space cisco.com and see what you get there. And it'll show you what I mean. It'll say request timed out, and what that means is they've got ping turned off, but what that can mean is that you're not actually getting a connection.
Request timed out because of what?
They have ping turned off in their firewall, and even the Windows firewall can disallow ping. So you can stop people from being able to ping you if you want to as a security measure, and a lot of companies do this. Google doesn't, I don't know why they don't, because they're enormous, but they seem to allow you to ping them. But in any case, it's a good way of also finding out an IP address. If you want to know the IP address of some website or other, you can ping that website, say pinggoogle.com, and it will have, the first thing it'll tell you is its IP address, pinging whatever it is with for lots of data or data.
So I can ping Elise's website and get her IP address?
You could.
Oh, I can
try
see.
Try pinging lonsdalemedia.org and see what happens.
I can see Google's address. It's 66.102.11.104, because it says next to it ping statistics 4 and then it does the address.
Okay, and because it starts with a 66 and I read out the ranges, what class of address is it? Can anyone tell me?
Class 1?
Class A, yep, the A, B, and
class
C.
A,
yes, you're right. Yep. Cool, did you all ping Elise?
Hang on for a sec. What's that, Kylie?
No, I've asked them, have they all pinged you?
What's the address again?
Lonsdale Media, LONSDALEMEDIA.org. And you should see a 110 address come back from that.
110175. Request timed out.
So you should be
getting
a ping. What did you get?
Request timeout.
Maybe I've got ping turned off too, come to think of it. Let me check.
No,
actually,
they got
I
partial
do too.
Address.
What did they get?
No, I request time. You have got ping turned off. Ooh, okay.
Yes. Well, all there
right.
You go. The router by default has it turned off. I think I remember Craig and I talking about it. So it's not going to let the ICMP packets in from the outside world. Uh-huh. There you go. Sorry, gang. You can if you want pinglonsdalemedia.com.au, which is now being hosted in the US, and that'll come back from a. I know, 50 address, I think. So ping lonsdalemedia.com.au or lonsdalemedia.com, and
well,
both those will come back from a different address.
No, don't do that, because if you get a no ping result, you might want to do something called trace route to see where the problem's occurring. Trace route will, what ping does is it sends the four packets to and from, what traceroute will do is show you the path that those packets take to reach their destination. And if it drops on the way, you can see where it's dropped. So try doing, the command is spelt T-R-A-C-E-R-T space lonsdalemedia.org and see what happens there. Now, for those of you in North American continent, you'll have a far different destination than those of you in Melbourne where Elise's server is. So, yep, and it will tell you in hops, and that's routers, and how many destinations it takes, and show you their addresses along the way. So, traceroute, lonsdalemedia.org. T-R-A-C-E-R-T, space, lonsdalemedia.org.
T-R-A-C-E-R.
T-R-A-C-E-R-T, trace route. Remember, this
basically
is like DOS,
taking
so we
the
have
O-U
to...
out of it.
Yeah, because we have to shorten to eight characters. It's a bit like our DOS again, Kate. So it's Trace RT.
I have no idea what I'm looking at here.
You're looking at the path that those packets are taking between you and Elisa's server. So that's what it will be telling you. And if it says request timed out, you can see where along it's timed out, and it'll help you to troubleshoot what the problem is. Basically, if the first thing you always see in a trace route is your default gateway address. That's always the first IP address you see in a trace route, because it's going out of your network and out into the big bad internet to trace the path that it's taking all the way over to Elisa's server. So it will be showing you the IP addresses of all the routers and things in between.
You'll see things there like ITPG, which is Internet TPG, which is my service provider, because I actually have that server at home. Oh, Kim's back, great. She's yelling. I think her ISP is going up and down. So what you'll see on that trace route, gang, is you'll see things like ITPG, and you'll see from the North American continent, if John trace routes it, he'll get more, he'll get others. Same with Kim. Kim and I often use it in the business because she'll get a different trace route to a server than I will, especially for the websites we're hosting in North America. So enjoy. What else was I going to tell you about all that? Yeah, so you'll get all different results.
Getting San Diego and... Okay.
Yep, you'll get all that sort of junk. I actually pinged an IP address or a server. You can ping any, you can actually trace her out to an IP address, or you can trace her out to a domain name. So as long as my domain name's been hooked up to my home account, you can do that sort of stuff with TPG. By the way, you can't do it with some of the bigger providers because they're big, mean, and nasty. So basically, you will trace route back to wherever the ARPA is for that domain, which in this instance is to my 110.175.41.16 IP address, which will probably end up right down the bottom of your screen somewhere.
If you're with TPG, how come it's got Telstra mentioned?
Are you with Telstra, Terry?
Yes.
There you go. Oh,
okay.
Just answers your question.
Why.
Because that's one that's part of the hops.
Through your ISP. There's, yep.
Yeah. Because it starts from you. Yeah.
So if I was going to trace route Elise's server, I would see Actrix in there somewhere, because that is the name of my ISP. Because they have routers and switches and hubs and all that kind of thing, much bigger than ours, in order to direct the traffic. And what's happening is it's trying to take the most efficient path possible between the two machines, between yours and Elisa's in this case. Okay, have we got any more questions before we close the command prompt and look at the physical components of a network?
Just one quick thing. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Terry.
I did what Elise said, excuse me, about the lonsdalemedia.com.au, and I gather that's a class A because it was 50 dot whatever.
It is. But one thing you have to be, it is a class A, and so too is the 110 address too. But what you need to be aware of is that with the addresses that are given out on the internet, we are not using, this sounds awful after we just told you about all the classes, but we're not using the class system like we used to. So you can actually see that the class system, if you look at a lot of Australian IP addresses, they're usually 205s and 202s, 203s, 22 something or others as well. They're not using the class system because we've started using classless inter-domain routing. And so even though we've told you about the classes, you're probably sitting here saying as students, what the heck did you tell us that for? You're now telling us at the other end of the lecture you don't need to worry about it. Well, sometimes you don't need to worry about it, sometimes you do. And this is one of the instances where you don't have to worry about it. But yes, to answer your question, Terry, you're right. It is knowledge you need to have when you're further down the track of networking.
No worries.
Yep. I've got an exercise for
next.
Kate.
Yeah, John.
Oh, go, John. Go, John. Yep.
It continued to say until it said, like, all the way through 30, and then time out complete.
Yeah, there'll be a maximum number of hops that you've specified that are the default. I can't remember off the top of my head what that'll be.
No, neither can I. You can change it.
Yes.
Ah, so well, there you are. You just answered my question. Yeah, because it said maximum number of hops was 30, and from about, I don't know, 8 or 9, they were just blank. So you can actually drop that down if you want to.
You can, or increase those if you've got a long path to trace route. So, but that's not covered in this course. You don't need to know about that. It is in Discovery 1. Actually, there's a cool little worksheet on trace route, which is kind of fun. But you don't have to do that here. Okay. Any more questions before we tell you about all the physical bits and pieces that make up a network?
And just something for the class, and I'm thinking here of Kate in particular. You're asking about your 192. I'm going to pick on you, Kate, because you're cool. 192.168.0.1, I think you said your router was. Ping it, see what happens. Ping that address like you pinged a domain name, see what happens, Kate. And anyone else who knows who happens to know what their integrated services router IP address is.
We are getting a bit short on time here.
All right, well, I'll tell you what will happen. You'll get all that for, you know, 4 bytes sent, 4 sent, 4 received, etc. So when you get an old hack like me around who's been troubleshooting for years, if you're having network connectivity problems, before you ring up your internet service provider and have to put up with the telephone jockeys, ping your local router, your local integrated services router, like Kate Kern, and if you don't get a reply back, you know your computer's not even connected to it, so don't bother your ISP over it, and you don't have to listen to them say, have you checked your browser settings? So you can start doing a little bit of troubleshooting yourself before you ring up and hassle and go into mortal danger and mortal warfare with your local internet service provider when you can't get a connection. So if you can't ping your local internet, your local gateway, then that's not your internet services provider's fault. Yeah, you can't get out. It means you can't get outside your own network. So look for a broken cable or problems within your own house.
Thanks, Ed. That's good to know. Okay, let's start talking about all these toys that make up the networks, because there's lots of them and they all do different things. Okay, physical components of a network. And these are the network devices which move data, known as traffic, around the place, and the media or cabling over which the traffic moves. Right. And so we can talk about computers, hubs, switches, routers, wireless access points are all physical components. And twisted pair cable, fiber optic cabling, radio waves are all network media. Okay, are we clear on which are physical components? Which one, which is what?
Your router, your access points.
The bridge and all that.
Yeah, they're all devices, and the cables and things that connect them, they're the media, okay? Right, we're going to talk about bridges and things now. Okay, but the first one is the most simple one of all. And it is a hub. Now, these are devices which take in the traffic from a source and blindly send it onto all the other computers connected to it. So, if John, Kate and I were all connected via a hub to Elisa's computer and she sent me some data, then Kate and John would also receive that data, which of course is not very efficient, especially if, like we all are, we were chatting a lot and very busy. So a hub just takes the data and sends it to every other connection on it, which is kind of handy, but it's a bit dumb. That's why it's called a dumb connection, really.
There you go. Sends it out every port except the port from which it was sent.
Yes. All right. Bridges and switches are a bit more efficient. On larger networks, sections need to be divided off for the sake of efficiency. Bridges and switches can help to keep the flow of traffic within the segment to which it belongs instead of sending it out to all and sundry. So a bridge or a switch keeps the messages in the segment that they belong to and instead of sending them out to everybody. A bridge will only decide if a message is destined for its connected segments or whether to drop it, and it usually has only 2 ports. So it's a little bit more sophisticated than a hub, but not a lot. A switch, on the other hand, maintains a table of the MAC addresses. And remember, I said MAC addresses are those ones that are burned permanently into your NIC. It has a record of all the MAC addresses on that network. And when a frame arrives at a port, see MAC addresses deal with frames, the switch compares the address information in the frame to its MAC address table. The switch then determines which port to use to forward the frame. So, if Kate, John and I were connected to Elise's computer via a switch and Elise sent me a message, the switch would be able to look up my MAC address and see that the message is destined only for me and not Kate or John. Do you see the difference?
Yep.
Okay, yes. So to summarise, a hub is a dummy. It just takes everything that it gets sent and forwards it on to its other, everything else that's connected to it, except the port it was sent from. A bridge can only decide whether it's going to send it on to its to whatever's connected to it or drop it. But, and it can decide, it's usually only one or two segments. But a switch has a record of all the computers on that segment, and it knows exactly where to send it. And so that's the basic difference between the three. Now, I've been talking about frames. A frame is basically a piece of data consisting of packets, which is the message broken up into little pieces of for easier transfer and error correction, inside information which tells the network devices where to send it. So it's something that wraps around the packets of the message. And it has header information and other stuff to tell the MAC address, to tell the switch where to send it. Now, frame is given by a MAC address. This information includes the MAC address of the destination computer. Okay, so when we're talking about layered models later on, yep.
So I guess your frame is a little bit like your envelope that's got where it's going to, and the packets are the letter inside the envelope.
Seems those people
like
are
that.
Getting a bit good, aren't they?
Yeah,
a little like
exactly.
That, yeah. And we talk about we actually do talk about encapsulation in the more advanced courses, Kate, where you are encapsulating and putting your little letters inside your frames or your envelope and sticking them in the post, and de-encapsulating them, which is opening the envelope and getting them out at the other end. So it's all cool, and you're learning stuff. And isn't this really good? Go, Kate.
Excellent. Any more questions before we move on to what a router does? Cool. Whereas a switch connects segments of a network, so a switch is good for segmenting off within a network, routers connect entire networks to each other. Okay, a switch connects segments of a network, a router connects networks. Okay. Switches use MAC addresses to forward frame within a single network, and routers use IP addresses to forward frames to other networks. So, say Elise sends a message outside her network where Kate and John and I are, and the switch goes, oh, okay, this is not mine, this has to be routed. And so the router says, okay, I've got the IP address information here, I need to send this on here. And so it goes until it reaches its destination. So once the message gets outside the local network, the router takes over and it uses the IP address, which of course is the logical address, not the frame, to forward the message on. Are we all clear about that?
Yep, makes sense.
So if I was at a big organisation and I wanted to send an email to someone else within the organisation, and the organisation's got its own address thing, server, that information, that email, doesn't actually have to go outside the organisation at all to get back to that person. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
The quick answer is yes, unless they've got some weird interesting things and they're using somebody else's SMTP server. But if the whole thing's done properly in-house and they're using the internal SMTP server, yep, the short answer to your question is yes, Kate, that's exactly right. A good analogy would be any message. If you wanted to draw up that scenario and said, I just want to send an instant message on an instant message client or something. So, yeah, pretty much it. Doesn't have to go outside, and it won't know anything about the big, bad, nasty internet, which is another network. It will just be kept inside the local one.
Which also means probably that it's got less likelihood of being corrupted in any form.
So the theory goes, yeah, because it has to travel less distance and doesn't have to go through any other networks on the way to its destination.
Okay, now routers have got tables of IP addresses along with the optimal destination routes to other networks, is why it's called a router, because it plots the optimal path between its message source and its message destination. And it has a table of IP addresses. Yep. And it uses IP addresses to do that rather than frames. Okay, a wireless access point provides network access to wireless devices such as laptops and PDAs. The wireless access point uses radio waves to communicate with the relevant devices in the computers, yeah, PDAs and other wireless access points. An access point has a limited range of coverage. So in large networks, you need several access points to provide adequate wireless coverage. Now, a multi-purpose device, and this is the one that most of us have got. Basically, your home device will be a multi-purpose device because it's a box, and on one end, separated from four holes where your network cables plug in, is an Ethernet port, and that goes out to your main network connection. That is
usually a cable router, a cable modem, or a normal ADSL modem.
Exactly, or into the wall. Now, so then there are four LAN ports, which you can hook things up to onto the network. That's actually a switch. So you've got an Ethernet port and a switch in your router. You also might have a wireless access point if you have wireless facility. So those things are all combined, and they're called a multi-service, multi-purpose device or integrated services router. And those are the things that usually you have for home use.
Now, I'll just get one thing. Can I just clear something up before I know?
Yep.
I know what's going to happen here. Okay, we do this in Discovery, and we'll give you a sneak preview of Chapter 3. There's two interfaces to that device, to the router part of that device. As Kylie said, it's got a switch in it. It's got a wireless access point, most likely, and it's got a router, and some of them have an ADSL modem. Most of them do these days, so it's an integrated services router.
Yep.
Now, with the router bit, there's two interfaces. The modem and the big, bad, nasty internet is on one interface, and your entire internal network, and that includes your access point, is connected via the switch on the other interface. A router has two interfaces. A lot of people go, oh, I've got four ports, and I must have the other interface, must be the wireless. No, the four ports and the wireless are on one interface of the router, which is the internal side, and the big, bad, nasty internet is on the other interface, which is where the modem is. Even if it's in the one box, or in the case of what we just mentioned before in my system, it's in a separate box with another Ethernet cable to the modem. So there are two interfaces, one to the big, bad, nasty internet and one to your home system with your four-port switch, or well, five-port switch, really. It's usually five physical ports that you can feel if you put your finger around the back, and the fifth port being for the wireless interface on the near side interface.
Yeah, so your internet has an outside and an inside. Techies tend to call them near or far side. I tend to want to think of them as internal and external. So, yeah, that's what that is all about. All right, before we move on to cables, are there any questions?
I don't understand what I don't know yet, so no questions here.
Okay, well, you can always give CL if you want to discuss anything further. That's fine. Okay, cables. Now, there are different types of cables for connecting with networks, and the type you choose will depend on the requirements of the network and the availability of services in your area. Now, twisted pair cable is a type of copper cabling that is used for telephone communications and most Ethernet networks. And so the cable, unless you're on a cabled network, if you're on DSL, you'll be using twisted pair cable, either connect up your telephone or to connect up your internet, and there'll be different categories of those. In twisted pair, a pair of wires forms a circuit that can transmit data. The pair is twisted to provide protection against crosstalk, or as your screen reader will say, crow's talk, which is the noise generated by adjacent pairs of wires in the cable. Pairs of copper wires are encased in color-coded plastic insulation and twisted together, and an outer jacket protects the whole thing. When electricity flows through a copper wire, a magnetic field is created around the wire. A circuit has two wires, and in a circuit, the two wires have oppositely charged magnetic fields. When the two wires of the circuit are next to each other, the magnetic fields cancel each other out. This is called the cancellation effect. And without that, your network communications become slow due to interference caused by magnetic fields. And we talked about magnetic interference back in Chapter 2, if you remember. And this way, so the more twists in the cable, the greater the cancellation effect, and the more efficient the cable.
And for okay. Terry Mack's benefit, Kylie summed it up much beautifully than I did yesterday. There you go. I think you're listening. I hope you are.
Thank you. Actually, I was reading from the notes. It actually summarised it quite nicely. So, basically,
yeah, it says it nicely, doesn't it?
Yeah. The cancellation effect is caused by the wires, by the magnetic fields in adjacent wires. And so the closer they are together, i.e. the more twists, the better the cable. Now, there are two basic types of twisted pair cable. Unshielded twisted pair has two or four pairs of wires, and it relies solely on the cancellation effect. It's the most commonly used cabling in networks, and it has a range of 100 meters or 328 feet. So, unshielded twisted pair, or UTP, is the most common Ethernet cable that you will find. But you can also get shielded twisted pair, or STP. Each pair of wires is wrapped in metallic foil to better shield the wires from noise. There are four pairs of wires are then wrapped in an overall metallic braid or foil. STP reduces electrical noise from within the cable. It also reduces EMI and RFI, radio frequency interference, from outside the cable. But it's more expensive and more difficult to install due to its thickness. It also has to be grounded at both ends to prevent unwanted noise. So it's just a pain in the bum and most people don't use it. It's most common outside North America. So the one that you really have to be knowing about is UTP, unshielded twisted pair. Now, there are several categories of this, and they're all based on the number of wires in the cable and the number of twists in those wires. That's a test alert. It's based on the number of wires in the cable and the number of twists in those wires. Okay, any questions so far?
No, don't think so.
Okay, Category 3, good old telephone cable. And that is used by telephones and Ethernet LANs at 10 megabits per second. It has four pairs and terminates into a 6-pin RJ11 termination. So the stuff that you see hanging around for telephones and really old networks at 10 meg, which you don't hardly see anymore, is good old Category 3 unshielded twisted pair Ethernet cable. Now, Category 5 and 5E goes at 100 megabits per second speed, and that also has four pairs of wires, and it's the most common Ethernet cable you'll see. That terminates into an 8-pin RJ45 connector, which you all know is the RJ11 on steroids. Category 5E has more twists per foot in its wire than Category 5 does. And of course, that means it has less interference for noise or crosstalk. Category 6, which is becoming more and more common, and Elise has some Category 6 in her network, is gigabit Ethernet, or 1,000 Mbps.
I do.
Again, has four pairs of wires with plastic dividers between the pairs, and more twists than Category 5E. Again, it terminates into a good old RJ45. So we have Category 3 at 10 Mbps, Category 5 and 5E at 100, and Category 6 at 1,000, and each has more twists than the other, and Category 6 also has dividers. Are we all clear on that before we go on to good old coaxial cable?
Yep, no trouble.
Okay, who around here has got a cable network, on a cable network rather than a DSL one? Anyone here?
Yep.
And I could be, but I choose not to be because I like the ADSL because they don't cap you. So, yes, we've got cable running past the front door here, Cable Extreme. And there is the coax connector even to this unit. So if I ring up the big mega service provider that provides it, you can have it here, but we don't bother.
Fair enough.
I don't, because they cap you.
I guess what a lot of people are saying is the houses are cabled up, but no one's using it because the plans aren't as good.
Yeah, I'm using it. I've got cabled right into my house. That's what my modem is, a cable modem, not ADSL.
So, Terry, you will be connecting by coaxial cable and not Ethernet, which is what we're going to talk about now. Actually, coaxial cable suffers from less interference than Ethernet, but it's a pain in the bum to install, which is why it's not used as much, even though it's actually better. And that often is the case. If you remember the war between the video formats in the 80s, Betamax against VHS. Yes.
Video home system.
Betamax was the superior one, but it lost out. So that often happens. Anyway, coaxial cable is a copper-covered cable surrounded by heavy shielding. It's much better shielded than Ethernet cable is. And it's used to connect computers in a network. There are several types of coaxial cable. ThickNet or 10 base 5. That's 10 meg, and that has a max length of 500 meters. ThinNet, 10 base 2. Don't worry about so much that. It's ThickNet, and that has a maximum length of 185 meters. Or RG59, which is most commonly used for cable television in the US. There's an RG6, which is higher quality cable than RG59, with more bandwidth and less susceptibility to interference. And that's really all you need to know about coax cable. It's that lovely round stuff with the screw-in connectors. It shields a lot better than Ethernet does, but its use isn't as common.
I think it's an F connector, isn't it?
It's an F connector in your case, yep. Some of the coaxes for our old CB and ham radio stuff use the BNCs and the PL259 connectors, which were much nicer than the F connectors. As far as I'm concerned, F connectors are aptly named.
Hey, but a question here. I've got, that's what goes to my modem from the hole in the wall, but then from the back of my computer into the router, I've got an Ethernet cable with an RJ45 on it.
You do. That's right. And from your router to your modem, you'll also have Ethernet.
Yeah. So it's not completely coax then, it's kind of a combination, isn't it?
It's coax on the modem side, on the wall,
on the external side.
So right from the provider along the street, and if it's anything like what we've got here in Australia, it's big ugly black junk that's strung up all around the streets and looks bloody awful. Comes into your house, comes through an isolation box on the wall on the outside your house, comes into your house, it's still coax, comes to a wall socket with a little round F connector on it, which is still coax and it's round. You'll notice the F connector is roughly the same size as the coax, the diameter of the coax, I beg your pardon. That's so as not to change the impedance of the line, because it needs to be 50 ohms. Changing the diameter of this and the dielectric in between will change the impedance. And then you'll get standing waves, and we won't go there. And then you go from that bit of coax, which goes from the wall up to your modem, where it's still coax, and then it gets modemized and turned into Ethernet and comes out a RJ45 connector and goes to your router. And in, you know, as I said, from that point forward, it's all RJ45 Ethernet stuff.
Which will be UTP?
Precisely, unshielded twisted pair. It's all in the exam.
Okay, the next kind of cable is fibre, good old fibre, and that's the coming thing all over the world. Now, fibre optic cable is made of plastic or glass, usually glass, and it transmits using pulses of light. And those pulses of light become light upon entering the cable and electricity upon leaving the cable. The glass fibres are enclosed in a jacket, and that means, and because it's made of glass, the cable is immune to EMI and RFI. Of course, it makes it a hell of a lot more efficient, but a hell of a lot more expensive. It can deliver signals that are clearer, can go further, and have greater bandwidth than cable made of copper or other metals. And we are so desperate here in New Zealand to get our cable, our horrible copper wiring, replaced with fibre, because it is oh so much faster and better. But it's damned expensive, and it's more difficult to install. Some common connectors you might see are SC, ST, and LC. These three types of fiber optic connectors are half duplex. And what did we say half duplex was?
You can only have a signal going one way at a time.
Exactly. So you need two cables per sheath in order to have two-way. Now, there are two types of fiber optic cable. Multimode is thicker, has a thicker core, and it's easier to make, and it uses simpler light sources like LEDs. It works well over distances of a few kilometres or miles or less. Single mode, on the other hand, is very thin core. It's much harder to make. Consequently, it uses lasers as a light source rather than LEDs and can transmit signals dozens of Ks with ease. Okay, so multimode is the thicker stuff and has shorter distance. Where am I? I've lost my place here. And single mode is the thinner stuff. It's more expensive, but it can transmit at a much further distance because of its light source, which is laser. All right, are we familiar enough with components and cables before we move on to topologies and architectures? This is all getting exciting.
Yeah, I think I'm fine.
Okay there, John?
Yes, and when I'm not, I certainly know where to find it.
Cool, no problem. I have no problem talking about all this stuff. It's all good. Yeah. Okay, 8.5. Describe LAN topologies and architectures. Now, architecture is, in this case, the overall design of a network. Within this, there are two topologies, physical and logical. Now, the physical is about the physical components of the network we've just talked about, computers, cables, devices. And the logical topology is about how the hosts communicate. That's all about IP addressing, computer naming, all that kind of stuff is logical. Therefore, a LAN architecture is about the hardware, software, and protocols which make up a network. Look at the diagram in 8.5 and you'll see the physical topology in figure 1 is about all the switches and the computers and so forth, and that figure 2 is about all the communications, IP addresses and so forth. Okay, so we're all clear on what a physical and a logical topology are. Okay, the first physical topology is called a bus. Now, in the bus topology, each computer connects to a common cable, so you get like a T system. The cable connects one computer to the next, like a bus line going through a city. The cable has a small cap installed at each end, called a terminator. And the terminator prevents signals from bouncing back and causing network errors. So that's a really simple kind of topology, where all the computers are connected just by one T cable. Now, in a ring topology, the hosts are connected in a physical ring or circle. So it's like the bus topology, but the two ends are connected without the caps. Because the ring topology has no beginning or end, the cable doesn't need to be terminated. Of course it doesn't. Now, a specially formatted frame called a token travels around the ring, stopping at each host, a bit like a bus stop actually, or a transport. If a host wants to transmit data, the host adds the data and the destination address to the frame. The frame then continues around the ring until the frame stops at the host with the destination address. The destination host takes the data out of the frame. Okay, so a bus topology is that one cable connecting in a T system. The ring is a physical ring. Now, the star topology is one that's probably what your home network is. It has a central connection point, which in your case will be your router or your modem, which is normally a device such as a hub, switch, or router. Each host on the network has a cable segment that attaches the host directly to the central connection point, just like your computers are attached to your router, either through a cable or through wireless. Of course, the advantage of a star topology is that it's easier to troubleshoot, because each host is connected to the central device with its own wire. And if there's a problem with that cable, only that host is affected. The rest of the network remains operational. And, of course, if you want to grow your network, you can just grow the star by calling it a hierarchical or extended star by hanging other devices off of it. It's the most common in organizations these days. So you'll get a central connection point with, like a router, with things like hubs or switches hanging off it, and that's an extended star. Now, have we got any questions on... No, sorry, there's only one more topology to go, and then we'll take questions, and that's the mesh. And I like to think of that as a grid, because in the mesh topology, all the devices are connected to one another. So when every device is connected to every other device, a failure of any cable does not affect the network. The mesh topology is used in WANs that interconnect LANs. Okay, so does anyone have any question about the various physical topologies? Okay, so the bus connects through one common cable with a termination at each end. The ring is a physical ring using the token passing control, and we'll talk about that when we talk about logical in a minute. And the star connects to one central point, the extended star having hubs and switches and things hanging off it. So are we all clear on what physical topologies are?
Crystal.
Cool. Now, the reason we have topologies, of course, which I didn't say, is that networks have to be planned. For instance, when the electrician wired up your house, they would have had to plan how to do it, where the wire was going to run, how, you know, what was the most efficient way of doing it, where were your power points going to be, all that kind of thing. And in the same way, networks, especially networks in larger organisations, have to be planned. So that's why we have the topologies. So I like to think of topology a little bit like topography, because it's all about the characteristics of the network. And we've just talked about the physical characteristics of that. We have a little bit more time, so we'll talk about logical next. Now, the first logical topology is the broadcast. In a broadcast topology, each host addresses either data to a particular host or to all hosts connected on a network. So your home network will be a broadcast topology, logical topology, because all of the hosts on that network will be able to communicate with each other, but not outside the network unless they need a router. So they're all on the same local network. And by local, I mean the internal rather than the external part of the network. Are we all clear on that?
Yep.
Okay. The other thing about a broadcast topology is that it's first come, first serve. There's no order in which these hosts can communicate. If you get in before somebody else, so if your daughter wants to send a message, Kate, before you want to, then that's what happens. Okay. There's also a logical bus topology, which is more likely to be found as part of an extended star, where hosts are connected via a hub. It doesn't actually mention a logical bus topology, what it is at all, in the notes, but it does mention that an Ethernet, which we'll talk about in a while, uses either a broadcast logical topology or a bus logical topology. So each type of network has its different characteristics, and we'll go on to that in a little while. The next logical topology is the token passing controls. Okay, now what that does is it passes an electronic token sequentially to each host. When a host receives a token, it can send data on the network. If the host has no data to send, it passes the token to the next host, and the process repeats itself. Now, you'll find those in older IBM type networks. They're actually being replaced by Ethernet today. So our physical topologies are all about the physical components and the way they're laid out. The logical topologies are all about how the data is shifted on the network. Are we all clear?
Topology can be, especially the physical topology, as I said to Terry and Kim yesterday, it's like the word comes from topographical, as in like looking down on a map, looking down on something. We look down on a topographical map.
That's what I just said.
Sorry. And you sort of like looking down on the layout of the network from the way the wiring's done around the house or around the office environment or around the physical part of your network. We had it going through classrooms, a couple of training rooms and a couple of offices in one of the training centres I worked in. And I still now visualise that, actually, when I think of that topology. I also think of that training environment and looking down on it, if I could be in the ceiling with a fisheye lens looking down on the whole, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 rooms, I have however many we had, the way it was all wired up.
Okay, I think we have time to introduce you to the Ethernet standard. It's the most common LAN architecture. And remember I said the architecture was about the physical and logical topologies and the characteristics of each. Now, the Ethernet standard is IEEE 802.3. We've talked about IEEE standards before. The most common ones will be FireWire at 1394 and parallel ports at 1284. This is a new one. It's IEEE 802.3. Now, its method of transmission is called, here's a mouthful, Carrier Sense Multiple Access with Collision Detection, CSMA/CD. And what that means is it's a first-come, first-served broadcast, as I said. So that means that the logical topology of an Ethernet network must be a broadcast one. If hosts listen for a clear line and then attempt to transmit, okay, if the line's clear, the message will get through. If two hosts, having listened for that clear line, should happen to do this simultaneously, then they send a backing off algorithm and work out when they're going to start all over again. So basically that's how CMSACD works. A little bit like a telephone line, I suppose. It waits for a dial tone before it can send its message. And if another one sends a message at the same time, they'll send a jamming algorithm and back off and wait and start all over again. And as Deb just pointed out, it's the same as a secure radio network, okay, which must also use the logical broadcast topology. Now, in an Ethernet, in the Ethernet LAN architecture, can use either a logical or a bus topology. And as I said, bus is usually found as part of a star these days, so it's not as common. And the physical topologies an Ethernet LAN architecture can use is a bus or star or hierarchical star. Now, Ethernet can transmit at 10, 100, or 1,000 megabits per second. The segment length is always the maximum of 100 meters or 328 feet. So that's the Ethernet architecture. And there's time just to cover the other two very quickly before we leave. The token. Now, the token was developed by IBM, and it's based on the token passing control topology, which I talked about before, and that was used in old mainframe environments. The physical topology looks like a star with devices connected to a central hub or multi-station access unit, MSAU. Inside the device, however, the wiring forms a circular data path, creating a logical ring. The logical ring is created by the token travelling out of an MSAU port to a computer. If the computer doesn't have any data to send, the token is sent back to the MSAU port and then out the next port to the next computer. So it resembles that token passing control that I talked about earlier. And that process continues for all the computers and therefore resembles a physical ring. Now, fiber distributed data interface is a type of token ring network, but it runs on fiber optic cable at 100 megabits per second. And it's usually a dual ring topology. The outer ring is the default primary ring and the one where the data operates. And the inner ring kicks in if failure occurs. It's used to connect geographically separated buildings, such as in a university campus. But it's being replaced now by fast Ethernet. There are more details in the notes, but basically that's what you need to know about the two architectures so far. We're going to introduce you more to the Ethernet next week, but we have run out of time. The next section will talk a little bit about standards organizations. I wouldn't bother doing this, but there's an exam question on it, so I'm going to run over it very quickly for you. Just be aware that there are lots of standards involved in networking, and it's good at least to be familiar with what they are. Now, has anyone got any questions before we end the lecture? Well, either I've bamboozled you all completely, or you're all wonderful and you've all got it in one. So, let's hope for the latter. yep, there's a lot to cover next week. So this is the start of the network chapter. You can look forward to an Easter break after this, by the way, too. So you do have that to look forward to. Read your notes, and if you have any questions, don't hesitate to yell.
I think you're done.
I think I might be. Thank you very much, people. Yeah.
Can I just ask Elise a question, sort of a lot off topic, to do with your Linux server? Can that sort of be set up on any PC, I gather?
most PCs will run Linux. Anything runs in Linux. Apple Macs will run Linux. Any Intel machine, yep. Any modern PC will run Linux. Absolutely. This is actually a EEE PC or a EEE box, actually, with the Atom processor in it that's running this particular one. But yeah, it'll run on anything.
Okay, folks, thanks very much for coming, and I shall see you all next week. Thanks for being such great people. You always are, and you've done amazingly well. Keep up the good work. Bye for now.